From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, alien implants. Here's what's happening. The U.S. military reportedly failed to intercept an incoming target in a ballistic missile defense test early Wednesday in Hawaii. If confirmed, it would be the second such unsuccessful test of a Raytheon missile within a year. A Massachusetts pharmacist convicted in connection with a deadly 2012 meningitis outbreak fought through tears as he apologized to victims and their families before being sentenced to 8 years in prison for his role in what's considered the worst public health crisis in U.S. history. Nearly 80 people died and almost 800 were sickened in the meningitis outbreak caused by mold-tainted steroid injections produced by the New England Compounding Center. Glenn Chin, who ran that so-called clean rooms where the drugs were made, sobbed as he struggled through a statement during his sentencing. Well, an unbelievable story. A man in China lost sensation from the waist down after playing video games continuously for some 20 hours at an internet cafe last week. How strange. Amazon, J.P. Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway are joining forces to create a healthcare firm aimed at cutting costs for their own U.S. employees. But how big can Amazon get? Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet. Lauren, how big can they get?
I think they can get as big as we let them get, basically.
My gosh.
If you're like me, the thought of Amazon getting involved in healthcare, because you know it's going to start with their own employees and then you know they're going to want to probably expand it outward, as if Amazon doesn't know enough about what you buy, where you go. A lot of people are putting their remote locks on their doors so that they know when the doors are open. They have cameras, the whole thing. So it's the kind of situation where if we don't start thinking about this, remember what happens with Amazon is when they move into an area, a different area of commerce, that has really drastic effects on other retailers.
Sure.
It started with books. Remember when Amazon, they started, it was just books. Now look what it is. They don't treat their employees very well either. You know, their warehouse workers are treated basically like robots. And in terms of expansion, I don't think we've talked about the fact that they had this contest, basically, trying to figure out where they're going to put their second full-scale headquarters. They had a competition, and 20 cities are the finalists, including Los Angeles, and I just hope it doesn't come here. We don't need the traffic, the additional traffic, and what would happen to housing costs and everything
sure.
else. But what's really interesting is a lot of these cities offered gigantic tax benefits to Amazon.
That's right,
we're
huge.
Billions of dollars of benefits, incentives to try to get them to come. They're never going to make those back. I mean, the technical term for that kind of thing is suckers, right? So, you know, Amazon does a lot of things that a lot of people use. A lot of people get a lot of valuable services out of them. But at some point, you have to start thinking about the balance. Do you want Amazon to be doing so much that all the other competition effectively withers away, and then what can Amazon do with prices at that point? We know the answer, just up, up, up.
Good point. Lauren, thanks. The Federal Reserve kept interest rates unchanged on Wednesday, but said inflation likely would rise this year, bolstering expectations that borrowing costs will continue to climb under incoming central bank chief Jerome Powell. Authorities in Peru have detained a truck driver accused of damaging parts of the world-renowned Nazca lines. Those are those lines, of course, that Eric Von Daniken wrote his book, Chariots of the Gods. Apparently, the truck driver was leaving tracks and damaging part of those lines. The night sky had a display in store on Wednesday. Tonight, the lunar event called the Super Blue Moon. Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. How good was it, Stephen?
Oh, George, I had hardly gotten any sleep, but who's complaining, right, when you love the sky? It started for all of us, particularly here in the Midwest and then moving on to the mountain states, and best seen, as many people now know, as it goes in the history books here in the Western time zone. But, George, photographs coming in from all people all over the place show the most amazing deep blood red moon, as you would expect, which is indicative of one thing. The brighter this moon is, in other words, the easier it is to see with that reddish color, it means that the atmosphere is pretty much free of the particulates of volcanic ash, which is a good thing. So we're looking now, George, for those that never got to see this really on the East Coast, here's probably the best news. We're treated to another one of these total lunar eclipses as early as the 21st of January next year. It's a Sunday night, Monday event. It'll be one of the descending node type of eclipses, meaning it's moving, the moon is of course going down through the constellations, moving to the southern sky. But the interesting thing about this, George, is that people will get to see this on the East Coast, and particularly the entire United States and North America gets to see all of the eclipse. And if you're lucky enough to be in the Caribbean, kind of a little head start, you'd be seeing the moon straight overhead if you were down just south of, say, Cuba or down through the Caribbean. A most amazing series of events. And finally, NASA marks 60 years in space, talking about this heavy launch rocket that SpaceX is going to launch in probably about a week or so. It started back 60 years ago with the launch of America's little Explorer 1, a small 30-pound little spacecraft that helped us to identify and really, quote, discover the Van Allen Belt. So much more to come, George. The eclipse was beautiful, and always a great part to be part of it is of Coast to Coast describing these events.
Thank you, Stephen. It truly is exciting. Up next, an American hero. He was last with me on our show 10 years ago, Daniel Ellsberg. His latest work, The Doomsday Machine. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. For the next couple hours, we are going to be talking with someone who I will call an American hero. For some of you who might be a little too young and you don't know, we're going to tell you a story. But in 1961, Daniel Ellsberg, a consultant to the Department of Defense and the White House, drafted Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's plans for nuclear war. Later, he leaked the Pentagon Papers. He lectures and writes on the dangers of the nuclear era and the need for whistleblowing. A senior fellow at the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, Daniel Ellsberg is the author of Secrets and the subject of the Oscar-nominated documentary The Most Dangerous Man in America. He's also a key figure in Steven Spielberg's film about the Pentagon Papers, The Post, starring Tom Hanks, and his latest work is called The Doomsday Machine. Daniel Ellsberg was with me almost 10 years ago on this program. Welcome back, Daniel. Good to have you with us.
I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
10 years. Wow, it goes by fast, doesn't it?
Well, not fast enough in a way. I'll be glad for it to be over. I don't want the next 10 years to be like the last.
No, I understand. I understand. And I want to, at least at this moment, thank you for what you did many, many years ago. For a lot of people who might not understand the significance of what you did in releasing the Pentagon Papers, but you went through a living hell, and thank God you came out of it okay. But we owe you as Americans a tremendous thanks.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate what you say. By the way, Richard Nixon, President Nixon, had in mind for me a living hell. I was facing 12 felony counts and a possible 115 years in prison. However, I did not actually have to experience that. Instead, President Nixon had to resign, facing impeachment in considerable part for criminal actions that he took to shut me up, to silence me during my trial.
Yeah, Watergate and, came up at the wrong time for them, didn't it?
That's right, and that seems very possibly to be looming ahead now for very similar reasons. Remember, critical to his downfall was the so-called Saturday Night Massacre when he ordered his attorney general to fire the special prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get tapes from the Oval Office. And then when the Attorney General refused to do that, Elliot Richardson, the next in line also refused. And they got down to Mr. Bork, who did fire the special prosecutor. But the outcry was so great at that, what they call the Saturday Night Massacre, with these two high officials being fired on the same night or forced to resign, that the they had to assigned a new special prosecutor, and in the end, the tapes did come out and brought Nixon down. But critical to what Nixon was worried about was that he had taken acts in fear that I had documents beyond the Pentagon Papers, which I did, and that I had documents from his own administration on Vietnam, which I did. It so happens that I didn't have what he most feared, documents that would back up what I was saying, and which turned out to be correct, that he was making nuclear threats to North Vietnam. And he'd done that as early as 1969. He continued to do it, even while I was in trial, and considered nuclear weapons seriously in 1972. So he didn't think that would play well with the American public, and was very anxious that I not put out anything beyond the Pentagon Papers, which that was a study of Vietnam decision-making that ended in 1968, before Nixon got into office. So it didn't incriminate Nixon, but he was afraid that I had documents that would prove that he had, in fact, been making nuclear threats and nuclear plans for an attack on North Vietnam, and other threats, including mining and B-52 raids on North Vietnam, a major escalation of the war, in order to win in a way that he really had no prospect of doing. Well, of course, when I say we're almost reliving that again, I'm seeing in tonight's emails a lot of speculation about efforts by this president, Donald Trump, to fire the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who in turn was in charge of a special prosecutor that Trump wants to get rid of, just as Nixon wanted to get rid of Archibald Cox. And if indeed he fires some of these people, others may resign before they carry out his wishes. We may have another massacre again, whether it's on Saturday night or not.
Jeez, let's hope we don't have to go through that again. For a lot of people, Daniel, who may be too young to even know what the Pentagon Papers are or were, what was it that made you release those? What did you see that made you say, I got to get this out into the public? And it went to the New York Times, I believe, right?
Well, I wouldn't have done that knowing that it would face me with life in prison or an indictment to that effect. I wouldn't have done that just to release history, which ended in 1968. We're talking about 1969, 70, 71 here now, when they finally came out in the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, The Post, which is the movie, The Post, which is a very good movie and very timely now, but it does give the impression that it was just the lies that were revealed in that historic study. You asked what the papers were for the benefit probably of most of your listeners. It was a 7,000-page, 47-volume study called, had various names, but U.S. Decision-Making in Vietnam from 1945 to 1968, 23 years there. And now we're talking about when I actually copied it in 69 and 70, and it came out in 71. This was history. We had a new president who was claiming to be a new Nixon, in fact, and was claiming that he had an entirely new strategy, which was quite misleading because he was making threats very similar to those that had failed against Vietnam in previous years. And they failed again, as I expected. So my concern was that I knew from having worked for the new administration as a consultant from the Rand Corporation on Vietnam options and some studies that Henry Kissinger wanted done for the White House, and I summarized those studies for President Nixon. That was early in 69. And I knew from my contacts there, and specifically from my friend Mort Halpern, who was a deputy to Kissinger at that point, that Nixon was not getting out. He was not ending the war. He, I think, expected to end the war favorably, but he was doing so by threats of escalating.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sure, as was Halpern for that matter, that these threats would not succeed. They didn't. And the next question was, would he carry them out? The Pentagon Papers showed me 23 years of previous history that presidents who drew a line like that were very likely to carry them out, even for their own prestige and their own status, their credibility, so-called, even though carrying them out was virtually hopeless in terms of achieving anything of benefit to the U.S. or anybody else. I thought, in other words, that he was likely to enlarge the war in the air, as he did do.
As he did.
And I knew this then from secret information given to me. I still had a top secret clearance here at the Rand Corporation, and I was a consultant, for that matter, to the White House in the beginning of the year. So I had this information. The public didn't have it, didn't believe it, but I didn't have documents on it. The Pentagon Papers, however, did document 23 years of four presidents lying in a very similar way, one after another, about what they were planning to do, why they were doing it, what they expected to come from it, and what was likely to happen. All of that was deceived by one president after another. And I hoped that that documentary proof would convince people in the Congress and the public that at least it was possible, as I was saying, that a fifth president, Richard Nixon, was carrying on much the same policy rather than lose in Vietnam or rather than get out, rather than be accused of having lost a country and suffered a defeat in Vietnam. He did what the others had done. He was planning to escalate the war and keep it going. He did hope to end it with a victory, but I felt that was futile, as it proved to be.
As it proved to be. It can cost him, what, 50,000 plus American lives and countless numbers of Vietnamese.
That's right. President Nixon is widely credited at his funeral and ever since with having ended the war in Vietnam. Actually, it didn't end while he was in office. He was removed before it ended in 1975, facing impeachment. But he did, in fact, add more than 20,000 names to that ominous Vietnam memorial in Washington.
Sad list.
58,000 plus American names on that. About 30,000 before him, actually, under the several administrations, but mainly Lyndon Johnson's administration.
How were you treated, Daniel? How were you treated during that time period by the American public at the time?
You mean right after I was indicted?
When that was publicized that you were the one that released the Pentagon Papers. I mean, were you treated with respect?
It was polarizing. There was the president and the vice president Agnew, both. Well, Agnew said it openly that I was a traitor. Nixon said that later, essentially. They didn't charge me with treason, by the way, because our Constitution defines treason very narrowly in a way that couldn't apply to somebody who told the truth to the American public, secretly to a foreign power, not as a spy. So I had 12 felony counts, but treason was not one of them, nor was perjury. So I was treated with these as having revealed documents that the public could actually read and see that this was information they should have had much earlier. So really, I was treated pretty favorably, pretty positively. There were many people who were very opposed to me. I got letters from them. And later, when Nixon lost office, largely as a result of his actions against me, a lot of people held that against me who were supporters of Nixon. And then I got a lot of abuse in the mail. But having almost miraculously escaped prison in this unprecedented way by the revelation of administration crimes against me. But it was a polarizing thing. I was called rather widely, just as Chelsea Manning and Ed Snowden have been called, traitors. That's a very, very unpleasant thing for a patriot to have to hear. But in a way, you never get used to that. But that's gone on for a long time. I got, in other words, the same kind of abuse that they got. But over time, and really pretty much at the time, it was so clear that this was information that deserved to be out, that the public deserved to know, needed to know, that I really got credit for it on the whole.
I mean, truth be known, a lot of people don't know that Ho Chi Minh, of course, part of North Vietnam, turned to us for help in the beginning.
Well, that's true. He actually quoted in his Statement of Independence from French, the colonial power, in 1945 at the end of the war. He quoted the Declaration of Independence very favorably and at the beginning of his speech, and wrote several letters to Truman, none of which were ever answered, actually, because for geopolitical reasons, actually, to get French approval to our rearming Germany, who had just occupied them a few years earlier, and to be partners with the French and to get them to agree to what we thought was a very essential economic move for European reconstruction, to get military aid to Germany. We turned a blind eye and actually supported their effort to fight their way back into this country as it declared independence And since you mentioned that, you say what really got to me. When I read the Pentagon Papers, doing research on them for the government.
Hold on for a second, Daniel. We're at this break, but we will come right back and talk about that. Then we'll get into your new work, The Doomsday Machine. Wait till you hear that story next on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back with Daniel Ellsberg in just a moment. His latest work is called The Doomsday Machine. Hey, a couple live events coming up. Salt Lake City, Scottsdale, Arizona, Las Vegas, Nevada. All kinds of great programs. Our live stage shows going to the theater. So come on by. Some great guests and everything else. Full information on all of these events. And I'll tell you, Salt Lake is March 10th. Scottsdale is April 21st. Las Vegas is June 9th. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com. At the top, you'll see events. Click that, and then click the opening, and all three of these events will pop up. Get your tickets and come on out. Already, the Las Vegas show is selling like hotcakes because a lot of people are going to go there on vacation, and they want to see the show, too. So just go to our events at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We'll take your calls next hour with Daniel Ellsberg as we talk about his work. We're going to get into his new work, The Doomsday Machine, in a moment. So, Daniel, we basically told the Ho Chi Minh, hey, go up the Ho Chi Minh Trail. We're not interested in helping you, I guess, huh?
Well, as I was saying, we were supporting the French, and really, when I read that, I'd heard that charge by anti-war forces. Remember, I was in Vietnam for the State Department
right.
for 2 years, and I'd come back from that and was doing research at RAND after I came back from the State Department and Vietnam on lessons from Vietnam, in that connection. I worked on what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers and later had them in my top secret safe at RAND doing research on recurrent patterns of decision-making in Vietnam, became aware of the kind that I'd been aware of when I was in the Defense Department in 1964-65, before I went to Vietnam. Anyway, what I read really in the early volumes of the Pentagon Papers, which was really corroborated what anti-war critics had been saying for some time, but it revealed that it was well known in the State Department and the U.S. government under Truman, actually as early as that, and then later Eisenhower, that we were supporting a doomed French effort to reconquer a former colony here. And that didn't constitute a noble cause in the eyes of an American like me. That was not a legitimate cause at all to be helping the French Empire reconstitute itself. And that meant to me that the war I'd been involved in, working in Vietnam for 2 years until I got hepatitis and had to come back, that war had been illegitimate from the start, from an American point of view.
Yeah.
And that meant to me that everyone who was dying in that war, really on both sides, as a result of when the French, the U.S. took over from the French War, essentially, which had been a French-American war, we were paying 80% of the cost of French involvement by the end of their campaign, that had been wrong from the start. And to me, that meant that it really ought to end right now, that it was a process of unjustified homicide, and that I shouldn't do what I had been doing for some time, and that was suggest ways that we might get out of there with a loss, without losing face, gracefully, not losing prestige over it. And when I read this early part, I realized, wait a minute, this war was not merely hopeless, which I'd understood in Vietnam, as did nearly every American who was involved over there, but it was wrong and must stop. Now, I knew it wouldn't stop quickly, and I now knew in 69 that Nixon was not ending it. So I was willing to do what I could, and at that point, to help shorten it as quickly as possible. And at that point in my life, I became aware that some young Americans influenced by Martin Luther King and mm-hmm. Gandhi before him were going to prison to protest nonviolently and truthfully what they saw, as I did, as a wrongful war that Americans should not be participating in. And that put the question in my mind for the first time, what could I do to help end this war now that I'm ready to go to prison for it? And that, before long, suggested to me that I had in my top secret safe, well, I was the only person at RAND authorized to even read those documents at that point, except for the president of Iran. And I had documents of lies by four presidents before them, like the lies that were being committed by Nixon right now in order to prolong the war, which Nixon's policies were going to do, and that might help to shorten the war. And I thought it would put me in prison for life, but that was worth doing, I thought.
Well, that's why you're a hero, because I do well, think you saved some lives. And I wish they would have listened to you way earlier. Let's talk about the Doomsday Machine, because you also worked on nuke programs, and apparently we secretly used nukes to threaten other nations. Nobody really knew about that, Daniel.
Well, that's what I was finding out about Nixon, who was doing it at that time. But the way I commonly put it is that we use nuclear weapons a lot. Presidents have, contrary to the belief that no weapons have been used since Nagasaki and Hiroshima. On the contrary, we've used them the way we use a gun, or anybody, I should say, uses a gun when they point it at someone's head in a confrontation, whether or not they pull the trigger. And in fact, if they get their way, if you get your way without pulling the trigger, that's the best use of the gun. That's why you have it. And really, that's a major reason why we've had nuclear weapons from that day till this. Really, Donald J. Trump is using our nuclear weapons right now when he's threatening North Vietnam. And for that matter, Kim Jong-un, very similar fashion, is using his nuclear weapons when he threatens retaliation. So this kind, in some cases, what you're referring to there, when I list in my book some two dozen or more cases where American presidents have made nuclear threats, usually in secret from the American public. Not from the recipient of the threats, obviously, or their allies, but it's the public that these are kept secret from.
Did the Soviets do the same thing?
In some cases, yes. In fact, we now know that when Khrushchev actually threatened the possible use of nuclear weapons over the Suez Crisis, which I was involved in as a Marine, I actually stayed. I asked the commandant of the Marine Corps to keep me on in the Marines for an extra year, because my battalion was going to the Mediterranean, and we knew that there might be a crisis or a war there. It was the Suez Crisis when Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal. And in that point, Khrushchev actually said to the British officials that he had weapons that could reach London and Paris. And interestingly, he didn't. He didn't have missiles at that time that actually could reach those. Later he did. But he was totally bluffing. And he felt, by the way, that he'd been successful in that when the American president failed to back the British and French attack on Egypt. And that encouraged him to bluff again in 1958. And after that, he gave warnings, or boasts, I should say, that he was turning out intercontinental ballistic missiles that could reach the United States. The sort of thing, by the way, that Kim Jong-un
He's doing the same thing, yeah.
He's doing the same thing now. By the way, I just saw today that a top U.S. General says, well, he doesn't believe they do have ICBMs. Kim Jong-un says they do. Our general says, well, we don't know for sure, but we haven't seen them with the components. It may be that Kim Jong-un is totally bluffing on the ICBM issue. But in any case, some of those threats by Russia, there were some later examples, in fact, at the time of the Bay of Pigs, Khrushchev said, that was in 1961, Khrushchev said that he now had missiles that could defend Cuba, which had come alive to him, from Russia. Well, he did. He had four. We had 40 at that time, 10 times as many. But and the Air Force was at that time, in the spring of 61, predicting that they, or estimating, that they had hundreds, actually, well, more than 100. And in August of that year, I was at Strategic Air Command headquarters in off at Omaha base in Omaha, and learned from their chief of war plans that the head of SAC, the commander of SAC, General Thomas Power, believed at that time that the Russians had 1,000 ICBMs.
Wow.
Or 40. Well, a month later, our reconnaissance satellite, our secret reconnaissance satellites, had revealed just a month later in September that they had four, by 250 times. But meanwhile, for the previous 3 years, I had been with all my colleagues at the RAND Corporation. I was one of the youngest, the junior ones of them. But we were all convinced by Air Force estimates that we were facing enormous superiority on the side of the Soviets, the missile gap, and also earlier a bomber gap, which turned out to be illusory as well. But we were trying to deter a nuclear surprise attack from Russia. And that turned out in September 61 to have been as illusory as the belief that Saddam Hussein had WMDs, weapons of mass destruction, in 2002 and 2003.
And of course, he never did.
So in other words, I discovered as early as 61 that a lot of very smart people, and I was working with very smart people, could be suffering from a delusion, in effect, working on the wrong problem and making the world less safe because the measures we were supporting and recommending were actually fueling an arms race at that point. And that's happening right now.
It is.
On both sides. Both the Russians and the U.S. now are building up we'll probably come to discuss this, what amounts to a doomsday machine on each side, a system of weapons and vehicles that could lead to near extinction of humanity. And we're rebuilding that. And it's been the same at the time with Putin. In fact, just last night, of course, Trump said, we will have parity. We will be the equal or greater, actually, than anybody else in the world, which we have been pretty much up till this time. And this has to do, I think very few people in this audience realize that what he was talking about was modernizing and reconstructing a doomsday machine, the term used by my RAND colleague, Herman Kahn. And it came up in Stanley Kubrick's film, Dr. Strangelove, the idea of a system that would destroy nearly all life on Earth. That's what we've had for over half a century. And the Russians as well. And we're both rebuilding them. This is a moral absurdity and extremely dangerous to humanity.
Daniel, who in God's name would want to use nukes? It's annihilation.
Well, here's something different about what's happening right now. Most of the threats you mentioned that I detailed in one of the late chapters by other presidents have been against countries that didn't have nuclear weapons, like North Vietnam. Nixon said he had a madman told Haldeman, his chief of staff, or rather his chief of staff, that he had a madman theory, that he was so obsessed with anti-communism that he might do anything, including use nuclear weapons. But that was not against Russia. That was against North Vietnam. Russia was its ally, but not likely to retaliate to an attack on North Vietnam. What's different right now is that we have a president who is threatening imminent attack, whether non-nuclear or nuclear, it's likely to go to nuclear war, against a country that has nuclear weapons, a nuclear weapons state. That's North Korea now. That hasn't happened since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. I was involved in that. That was at a high staff level. That was 55 years ago. And it hasn't happened since then that the prospect of a two-sided nuclear war has been really the subject of threats. So this is a very ominous time. Even if Trump is bluffing, as Khrushchev has bluffed, and perhaps some other presidents were bluffing at various times, whether he is or not, Kim Jong-un is every danger that in their maneuvering, the rehearsals on both sides for war, that will blunder into a war that would be, even if it didn't lead to the nuclear winter that kills everybody, it would kill millions of people.
Oh, it would be a planet killer, I think.
Well, not so much, if I may say, just to put this in context, North Korea is the only one of the nine nuclear weapon states that doesn't have enough weapons to cause nuclear winter. And we're talking about near extinction. If I may, let me just...
But China could jump in, right? And then Russia could jump in.
Yeah, they could. And moreover, what is really possible is that in the course of a war like that, which in its immediate effects, doesn't threaten to kill everybody with nuclear winter, there could be a false alarm of the kind we just had in Hawaii, except that, you know, that just scared a million civilians in Hawaii into a lot of desperate and futile actions, like jumping into manholes or speeding along the freeway. Similar false alarms have occurred even during crises like the Cuban Missile Crisis at a high level, at the level of the North American Air Defense Command or Strategic Air Command and the White House and Russia. They have occurred in Moscow in 1983, again in 1995 after the Cold War. If one of those occurs during a North Korean-U.S. war, it will be taken, I think, as the symbol, as the, if it's believed, for a matter of minutes too long, it could lead to preemption by one side or the other in North Korea, and that could threaten everyone on Earth.
Yes, absolutely. There's always been an argument that using the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki ended the war and saved a lot of American lives, yet people who are opposed to the use of nukes say we're still the only nation on this planet that has used them. How do you look at that? Did they indeed stop the war?
Work backwards a little bit. You know, we were just having a discussion. The word use is a little ambiguous there. And as I say, we have been using them continuously in NATO as a deterrent, and in the U.S., the threat of first use of initiating nuclear war. And we've, in specific crises, actually pointed the gun without pulling the trigger. And a few times, so has Russia, much less, and others. India and Pakistan, by the way, are pointing that weapon at each other right now over Kashmir, as they have in the past. They're making threats about their readiness to use nuclear weapons. And they have more, much less than we do, but more than North Korea, enough to cause not a full nuclear winter, but enough to starve by nuclear famine and the effects on the weather, 2 billion people, a third of the Earth's population. But to get back to your other question on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's really a very complicated, controversial question. Of course, the public, by and large, I'd say the majority, has always been led to believe that the war, which did end just weeks, actually the weapons were on the 6th and the 9th of August in 1945, and the war was over a matter of weeks later. And so it was very plausible that they had, in fact, caused the end of the war. What the public didn't know then, and mostly doesn't know now, but what we did know from listening to Japanese intercepted communications, that they were in fact arguing, negotiating for surrender. They hoped to Russia to be an intermediary. Russia had been neutral up to that point, and they hoped that Russia would intercede for them and get them better terms, in particular, let them keep the emperor. Well, we were prepared to let them keep the emperor,
right,
so as to get a more orderly surrender and get surrender of the troops, and even govern Japan under General Douglas MacArthur later. So we intended to keep the emperor, but we hadn't told them that yet. We knew, however, that they were interceding with the Russians to do that. The Russians were scheduled to get in on August 8th, which they did do, in fact. And it was very likely we knew that at that point, without a bomb at all, that the Japanese would then give up on Russia as an intermediary, turn to us for terms, and we were prepared to give them the term of keeping the emperor. So the war was likely to be ended without any use of the bombs about at the same time. The Nagasaki bomb was August 9th. The Russians came in the night of August 8th, and the war would have ended probably within weeks after that, without the bomb.
That's what I had heard. Daniel, we're going to come to the top of the hour here, but we're going to come back and talk more about your work, The Doomsday Machine, and we'll open up the phone lines as well. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.